Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. And on this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on reading waters. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up for our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about reading waters. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts, and to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Gary tonight, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gary's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary's latest book, Reading Waters. Here's how you can win this book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Gary and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll be the lucky person or the person listening the most to win Gary's new book, Reading Waters. Tonight our guest is Gary Borger. Gary has a Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. During his teaching career, he taught botany, zoology lab, natural history photography, writing in the sciences, ecology, taxonomy, and other topics. He was presented with Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary is one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He's been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally on all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and active member of Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor for Fly Fisherman Magazine, Editor-at-Large for the Virtual Fly Shop, and Fly Fishing Columnist for North American Fly Fishermen. He has written five best-selling books on fly fishing, nymphing, naturals, the Borger Color System, Designing Trout Flies, and Presentation. Gary also pioneered fly fishing video instruction with his release of Nymphing in 1982. Since then, he has appeared in four videos on the 3M company and is in cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers, produced environmental video, Where the Trout Are. His video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he has appeared in TV productions on ESPN and OLN. Gary is also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. He is a founding member of the Board of Governors for the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Casting and Structure Certification Program, a member of the Order of the Jungle Cock, Trout Unlimited, United Fly Tars, and Federation of Fly Fishers, and many more that we don't have time to list tonight. Well, Gary, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. You used up about half the program on that stupid bio.
Well, you got to quit being so accomplished, and now you're writing even more books. So, the list will get longer, I guess, you know. But some of your older books are classics, so we got to let people know about that.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And some of that information just doesn't it's evergreen, isn't it? I mean,
that's right. Some of it is never goes away.
Yeah, it's things that worked 25 years ago still work today, and if you use them. So let's dive in here on reading waters, and got a bunch of questions tonight, and it's you know, I think this is something that people struggle with so much. So let's start with the basics and kind of walk people through tonight, and I've pulled some of my questions from your latest book, Reading Waters, and we won't be able to cover that whole book by any means, but let's give them a taste of what's in that book tonight. And let's start with, and you kind of started the book with talking about the life rules that fish live by, and maybe that's a good place to start, and you can kind of go through that.
Sure. There are really the life rules for all biological organisms. But as anglers, we really need to be aware of them, specifically the way they apply to fish. And the easy way to just to talk about them is, number one, don't get eaten. The number one driving life force is to prevent predation, to stay alive. And so that's the first thing on the fish's mind, not getting that juicy mayfly off the top, but keeping a predator from eating it. The second thing is, of course, to get something to eat, because if they don't eat, they die. And the third thing is to reproduce. Now, in order of importance, they are, number one, don't get eaten. Number two, get something to eat. Number three, reproduce. So the really critical part of reading the water is understanding that fish are super, super spooky, much more spooky than most anglers give them credit for. A wild brown trout is every bit as spooky as a 10-point, you know, mule deer or a 10-point whitetail. We have some advantages as anglers because they can't see out of the water as well as a deer can see across a field and see us. So we do have some advantages there, but they are every bit as spooky. And so when that fluorescent orange fly line goes flipping back and forth over top their head 27 times, they're out of there. So that's probably the first thing that we need to keep in mind, and if everybody did keep that in mind, they'd probably catch a lot more fish regardless of how they read the water.
Well, even us as humans are in that same mode, aren't we? I mean,
that's exactly right.
We're walking through the woods and we hear a twig snap. We jerk. We're startled, and
why?
That's that inner fear mechanism kicking in, saying,
that's
"Hey,
exactly
you might be eaten too."
Right. Climb a tree, quick.
Yeah. So that's
one thing that really determines how we approach the river, how we think about what's in the river, how we think about our relationship to the fish relative to where they are and what they're doing and so on.
Do you think we don't spend enough time thinking about that when we approach the lives and so forth?
Absolutely. In fact, that's going to be book number three is Long Flies, and that's going in just here shortly, and the fourth book is The Angler's Predator, which we'll deal with that in much more detail. But it's a way of thinking about how you not only approach the river, but how you read the water, too. For example, if people really spent a lot of time looking, they'd find a lot more fish in shallow water than they normally do. Most people think, okay, shallow water's for wading in, deep water's where fish live. But shallow water's a real good place for fish because it's a lot easier for them to find food there. So as a consequence, many people walk over fish that they should be fishing to. Joe Brooks, in his book, Trout Fishing, which was his last great book that he did, said, never wade through water you haven't fished. Didn't matter how shallow. He always started in the shallow stuff and fished it, and if he didn't get anything there, then he would move into it. Otherwise, he fished it, even if it was only just, you know, as deep as the top of his wading shoes.
And that's and probably 80% of the people that I've seen fish just walk right in.
Oh, sure.
Well, me included, many times.
Well, I do it too sometimes, you know, without even thinking about it. You just go, oh, there's a good spot, and you wade out there and spook five fish in the process.
Right, right. And you know, I think some of it goes back to when you were a kid. I don't know, you know. You drop a worm in the water, and you got to try to find the deepest hole, because, you know, the biggest
right.
fish is at the bottom of the deepest hole.
That's right.
So some of that I must still ring true, in my mind anyways. But, well, let's... Okay, so with that in mind, you talk in your book about the different lies that fish spend their time in. So can you kind of describe those? And,
sure. And I think this is a good way for anglers to think about the way, you know, once they get in their mind that they're going to be a predator and that they're going to be more watchful about reading the water, then the next thing they need to do is start thinking about why fish are where fish are and what they're doing there. The place that a fish holds is called its lie, L-I-E. And the one rule about all lies is that they must have protection from currents. Fish can't really swim in currents very long. If you think about it for a second, the way we tire fish out to land them is we make them swim. And if they swim fast, they get tired. Well, if it had to swim in fast water all day long, you'd never be able to land them because they'd be so strong that, you know, they just couldn't pull them in. So fish, somehow or other, have to stay out of current. In a riffle, for example, they're down on the bottom behind a rock in what we call a hydraulic slip, hiding from the current. So a number one rule in any reading the water is fish must have a place to stay out of the current. Then, beyond that, we can divide the lies into three categories. The first is the sheltering lie, which is a place where fish go for protection from predators. It's not a place to go to eat. It's not a place to just go hang out and lie around and do nothing. It's a place where they go specifically to get away from predators, and that means under something. Under a rock, under a log, under the bank, under a fallen tree, under deep water, under deep fast water. Some place where they can be as far away from the surface and predators and prying eyes of predators as they can possibly be. Fish in sheltering lies are not feeding. They're there for protection and protection only. Typically, they go there when they're scared. So if they're scared, they're not going to be eating. The second kind of lie we need to pay attention to is the feeding lie. That's the place where fish go when they're aggressively looking for abundance of food that's floating in the river. So it might be terrestrials floating on top. It might be a hatch going on. It might be an abundance of scuds floating by or something. Fish tend to congregate when they're scared, but when they're feeding, they tend to get more territorial and move out into very specific places where they can hold and watch for food coming toward them in the currents. Now, the interesting thing about the link between these two is if I hook a fish that's in a feeding lie, which typically is in shallower water, then it's going to run for the sheltering lie. If I know that, I can anticipate beforehand, here's a fish in the near shore water, looks like it might be a foot or a foot and a half deep. If I hook it, it's going to try to run across the stream and get under that big fallen tree over there. It's not going to stay in the shallow water and fight. So I can anticipate beforehand what's happening and be ready for it when it does happen. Most often people fight fish just by sticking the rod up in the air and hoping that something happens and they eventually land it. You know, they reel when the fish doesn't pull, and they let go when it does. But if we anticipate beforehand what's happening, we can try to avert that by moving the rod out to the side and pulling the fish's head around or whatever it is that we need to do. The third kind of lie is what we call a prime lie. That combines the characteristics of both a sheltering lie and a feeding lie. In other words, it's under something, and it's got a food source coming. So it could be under the deep water in a heavy riffle, with a food source drifting along the bottom, could be back under a bank, could be under a log or a big rock or in a deeper part of a pool or something like that, as long as there's protection there and food at the same time. On a day when there's really no hatch going on and there's, you know, not much happening, the best place to look for is the prime lies, because those are the places that you're going to find fish in a ready-to-feed position. I'll give you a couple examples of prime lies. Right at the very head of a pool where the riffle comes in and the water the banks off sharply and drops into the deep gut of the pool, that is a prime lie if the water in the riffle is more than about knee-deep. If it's a very shallow riffle coming in, the fish probably won't hold there because there's not enough water above them to make them feel protected. But if the water's more than knee-deep and it's a relatively fast riffle coming in, there'll be fish there all the time feeding. You go over and fish the bighorn, for example. I mean, you've fished that many times, I'm sure. That is one of the absolute best places in the whole river. You can nymph that. In fact, I know guys that stand on one of those spots and just fish all day and catch fish all day. So those are the that's one kind of a place where you might find a prime. Another one's back under a bank. If you have a current going back under there with a foam line and it's carrying food and stuff back under the bank, fish can hang back there all day long and have a continuous supply of food coming to them. So when we're fishing and reading water in streams, what we're looking for are feeding lies and sheltering lies and prime lies, and thinking about how fish are going to be reacting to what it is that we're doing relative to their, you know, the predator kind of thing, plus what they're doing relative to the food sources that might be around. You know, people say, well, the best time to fish is morning and evening. Well, if there's a giant hatch going on in the middle of the day, that's the best time to be fishing.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, there's a lot to be said for the timing of these events, and then reading the water is going to be different then than it would be morning and evening. So we have to always think about the fact that fish are seeking food, will move to get food, will move out of sheltering lies into feeding lies, out of feeding lies over into prime lies. If they're frightened, they zoom back into the sheltering lies again. And they're not just static and holding one place in the river waiting for us to come and catch them. They're moving around watching for food all the time. And that's one of the things. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I'm trying to think about the sheltering lie, because so many times we look for what I would think would be a prime lie. It might be a sheltering lie. In other words, the undercut bank or the under the log or something. But there might not be really a lot of food source there. If it's, still water, there's nothing new coming in there. The only thing might be a terrestrial plopping on the top or something. So some of those, what might look like a prime lie, might not be, because there's not really a constant food source coming in.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about this concept of deep water. You know, everybody thinks that the deepest part of the pool in the center has the biggest fish in it.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily so. That might be the sheltering lie for the pool, because there may not be anything else around there except deep water, and that's where they go to hide.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times when I fish up on the bighorn, for example, I'll catch big browns and stuff right up tight against the bank, feeding underneath the bushes and stuff on terrestrials or midges or something. And the first thing they do is shoot for the middle.
Mm.
Because that's where the deep water is. They don't go, you know, racing up in the shallows and fight in that deep water. And of course, if there's a big log laying out there, that's the place you want to watch that, because that's where they're headed for immediately.
Right.
And it's
do
not
they
because,
get comfortable? I mean, do they get comfortable in their lives where they kind of forget about predators after a while and everything's going great?
They
something?
Never forget about predators.
Okay.
That's just built in. You're sitting there in the forest eating your sandwich, having a really good time talking to your buddy, and the stick cracks, you hear it.
Yeah.
They're the same way. You know, they're always watching for predators.
Now, Darren in Idaho Falls, Idaho, wrote in and he says, could you please discuss the steps you go through for reading water when you first come to a piece of water and you plan to fish, especially if it's water you haven't fished before? So this is how you approach it, is you're looking at these lies, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That and the abundance or absence of, readily noticeable food items. Like if there's a hatch going on, first thing I want to do is start thinking about, okay, where the feeding lies are going to be, because fish will have moved out of prime lies and other things spread out to get into these feeding lies so they can maximize their food intake. And if there's a hatch going on, you know, I'm going to be watching the tail out of the pool. I'm going to be watching the edges of the pool. I'm going to be watching up on the top end of the pool where the fast water comes in. I'm going to be watching the edge of riffles. I'll be watching fishing the secret river and rapids and that sort of thing, rather than just, you know, casting out in the middle and hoping for the best. A lot of times, bigger fish actually will be in shallower water because that's the best place to get the food. You fish over in Henry's Fork, you see a big rise out in the middle. You know, you fish Henry's Fork, you can always tell the people that have not fished very much because they're out in the middle waiting around casting all the small fish. The guys that really fish Henry's Fork and understand it know that the really, really big fish are probably within 2 feet of the bank, on those little curlouts where the water goes out around a rock or hits a clump of sod or something, and there's just a tiny line there. and then you get, you know, a real stack of insects going down. And a big fish can lay in that water. It's maybe only 6-7 inches deep, and just stick his nose out very gently and suck in one insect after another. Part of understanding why fish do that is you've got to understand the whole idea that life depends upon how much energy goes in versus how much energy goes out. So if a big fish can't eat enough food to keep itself alive, it dies. But a big fish can't feed like a small fish because a small fish doesn't have much body mass. A small fish can zip around and grab food and do all kinds of stuff, and it gains way more calories per ounce of body weight than a big fish eating the same food. So a big fish may have to eat 20 insects to get the same food value for its body as a small fish eating one insect. So a big fish can't afford to race all over the place. It's got to find a spot where there's a heavy food source, and it's got to minimize its energy expenditure and maximize energy intake. That's why bigger fish generally start feeding on things like crayfish and minnows and, you know, salamanders and other trout and frogs and other kinds of things that have a large caloric value, because they need so much food to keep themselves alive and to move their body mass around. So when you're thinking about, you know, what are these big fish doing in shallow water? Well, they're in shallow water because it's the easiest place for them to catch food. And of course, that's also where they're going to be the spookiest, too.
Yeah, and they're exposed.
That's right.
Yeah. When a fish goes into a sheltering lie, have you come to any, you know, is there any kind of rule of thumb as to how long they'll stay spooked?
That's a really good question. I mean, I've spooked fish and had them spooked the rest of the day, period. They're just gone. On the other hand, I've had fish where I've hooked them, broke them off, and 10 minutes later caught the same fish again and took my fly back. It's weird. Yeah. You just don't know.
So it's just,
I mean, I was fishing for big browns one time over here on Lake Michigan on the tributary streams, and I foul hooked one in the tail. And, of course, I broke it off immediately. And I thought, well, you know, that's the end of that. And I'm starting to walk away, and I see this white thing out there coming back. Here it swims back up and gets in the same spot, and I made two more casts and caught it and took the fly out of its tail and, you know, let him go. You just don't know.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on the individual fish.
And maybe how they were spooked, and in that case he might, you know, I mean, he was wounded, but maybe he just thought it was a stick or something.
Yeah, you don't know.
Yeah. What we've got a question from Martin in Lawrence, Kansas, and he asked, "What? How much does the time of day affect where the fish lie?"
Well, I would say rather than time of day, I would say food availability. Food availability determines more where fish will lay than the time of day. For example, you go and fish like the Madison, or you go over and fish the Gallatin, or you fish the Big Hole, or, you know, Henry's Fork, any of those rivers during the pale morning dunhatch, they're right out there in the middle of daytime chomping down.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go there, you know, 2 weeks later when the hatch is over, you don't see anything. So the food availability determines where the fish are going to position themselves. If there's a high abundance of food, they're going to be out in those feeding lies. They're going to be watching for food. The time of day has nothing to do with it. Of course, during the daytime, they're going to be a whole lot more spooky than they would be at night, obviously, or in low light level.
Right.
And so fishing right at morning or right in the evening, there's less chance of fish seeing you, less chance that they're going to be spooked by your line and by your casting or awkward waiting or whatever. But during the daytime, of course, when there's bright light levels, it's easier for them to see you.
Yeah,
the other thing is that on western streams, high mountain streams especially, at least 50% of the fish's food intake comes from terrestrials. So they're out there basically all day long watching for terrestrials. They're out in feeding lies, watching for grasshoppers and ants and wasps and beetles and whatever happens to fall down there. So they're positioned, you know, to take advantage of the time when there's a maximum food drift. If there's really nothing going on in terms of hatches and all that kind of stuff, you know, morning and evening can be good, because what we get is what we call behavioral drift. That is, there are certain insects like black fly larvae. Sometimes scuds will be involved. Sometimes Betis nymphs will be involved. And a few other organisms that will just come up out of the bottom and drift in the currents.
Mm-hmm.
Biologists think that it's probably a dispersal mechanism so that they can, you know, there's too many of them in that area, so they move a little bit. But we're not really certain absolutely why they move. But they do, and of course, if there's a lot of them moving around, there will be fish feeding on those, smaller fish as well as bigger fish. And of course, a lot of times when the smaller fish are out, the bigger fish are eating smaller fish too.
Right, right. Because the smaller fish feel safe, so they come out.
And they're chomping around. Of course, the big fish come in and pick them off.
I know we've been talking about streams and rivers here, but I know at the small lake that I fish right by my house here, that half an hour before the sun goes down is just prime time all the time. The big fish, I catch most of my big fish within 3 feet of the shore on the lake because of that. They come in
absolutely
at that time. Yeah, feel safe and come in. So I guess the answer to the next question is probably the same. Steph in New Mexico wonders about cloud cover. And also water temperature. And are you going to answer it the same way? Depends on the food.
Well, a little bit it does. There are some days I've seen when it's overcast, when the sun would break out and the fish would just stop eating, and the clouds would come back and they'd start feeding again. The reason, it doesn't have really a thing to do with the food source. It actually has to do with the fish's eye. The fish's eye, like our eye, can become adapted to lower light levels. But it takes them a lot longer. It takes them approximately an hour, where it takes us just a few minutes. So if a fish is feeding on a heavy overcast day and their eye is adjusted for the darker light and clouds break and the sun comes out, they're basically blinded for a while. And so a lot of times they'll stop feeding on the surface and begin feeding underneath. But in terms of cloudy days versus sunny days, I'd rather have cloudy days anytime. And the reason is that fish feel safer, and they move around more. Sunny days, they feel threatened. I mean, you can imagine, bird flies over, they see it.
Overcast, just like we can see the fish easier. Yeah.
Sure. So same kind of thing. Overcast days tend to be a little bit better, especially if I tell you what, if I'm fishing for big browns and I have slightly rising water and a warm rain, oh, man, I know I'm going to connect. They like that kind of stuff. Slightly rising water, you know, it's been raining for a day or so, and the water's coming up a little bit, and it's sort of warm and overcast. Ooh, they'll be moving because they don't feel threatened at all.
Right, right. We've got a question from Ken in Granite City, Illinois. He's asking about, he says, in southern Illinois, they have a lot of muddier rivers. And, you know, how does that affect? Again, we're talking about visibility for the fish.
Right.
Are they safer there? Are they, you know, how do they find food in the muddier waters? Does it affect their lives?
You know, fish in more turbid water, whether it's caused by mud being in there, or whether it's caused like it is in the Amazon basin by decaying vegetation and so on, they have to be more tuned in to the sound of the organism than they are to the sight of the organism, because obviously they're not going to see it as far away. If there's a big hatch going on, they'll just get close to the surface and watch the surface, unless it's super dirty, which, it, you know, then in that case, it's basically all sound kind of stuff. And when I'm fishing water that's turbid and there's nothing going on the surface to move them, I want flies that generate what we call a large acoustic footprint. That is, it pushes a lot of water so that it sends out the kind of vibrations that a minnow would send out when it's swimming. I know that in this day and age, probably for the last 500 years, people have sort of poo-pooed the idea of putting spinner blades on streamer flies and that kind of stuff. But actually, in the streamers and bucktails and other kinds of long flies are in a strictly American product. They developed in the late 1800s, early 1900s in the United States, and in about the 1920s, 1930s, people were hanging all kinds of spinner blades and other kinds of things on them. But then when spinning gear was introduced in the United States, people stopped using spinner blades because they didn't want people to think that they were spin fishermen, I guess.
spinner blades,
and muddlers are a very good example of a fly that pushes a lot of water.
Yeah.
Because that big head in the front displaces water and pushes water out to the side. Now, if I was designing a fly, I'd design a fly that had, and I've designed a lot like this, that have a big head that pushes a lot of water. And then the rest of it is not like a muddler, just stick-like. It's got all, you know, like a strip of hide with the fur left on, or it's got marabou on there, or something that's really swimming a lot. The fish hears the fly, comes over and sees the thing swimming and nails it.
Yeah. Well, Gary, we have to take a quick break here.
Okay.
And we'll be right back, and then we'll dig into this a bit more.
Excellent.
Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Gary Borger about reading waters. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Gary, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's been going on in your fly fishing world, and I know what's been going on in your fly fishing world, but why don't you share with people this grand project that you're working on?
Well, this is a 20-volume book project called Fly Fishing, and the idea behind it is to cover the whole of fly fishing in such a way that, not like an encyclopedia, but in such a way that it brings better understanding of the underlying concepts that drive us, you know, the sport of fly fishing. Not only the rules that we have as made up as fly fishers and the gear that we use in casting and all that kind of stuff, but the underlying concepts like we're talking about now, you know, the three life rules and the lies and those sorts of things, to give people a better understanding of how to approach this sport in a way other than just guessing by gosh. And Jason, my son, is involved in it in that he's editing the books. He's also doing all the artwork for them. He also does all the layout and design and press preparation and all those sorts of things, in addition to doing some writing for them, too. So it's a grand project, and it's going to take us between 5 and 6 years to complete it. And book number 3 is being laid out right now and is headed to the presses probably in a couple months.
Oh, great. Great. You guys are moving right along here.
We have to. Yeah.
Well, looks like we'll be talking again in a few months.
I think so. On long flies will be the next one, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what do you mean by long flies?
By long flies, I mean the uniquely American-developed imitations of bait fish and frogs and snakes and salamanders and, you know, anything that's long and typically typically organisms that move about rather than just, you know, dead drifting in the current and so on.
Right. Now, well, good. Well, I'm looking forward. I've enjoyed your two books already, and I think I'm looking forward to the rest. I think that'll be great, a great legacy to leave too, for the two of you. When we were just talking about the long flies, in fact, you know, in the muddier waters or turbid waters, if you're on a stream, again, looking for the lies and so forth, are you better than looking for shoreline? I mean, a lot of times I know in Colorado when the water's running dirty, it's because we're running a lot of water too. You know, there's a lot of runoff, and where do we look for the fish in those situations?
Generally speaking, in flood conditions, fish just move out into the shallow water at the sides. They get out of that heavy current because they can't stand in it. I mean, they can't swim in it. Number one, number two, there's too much gravel and other kinds of garbage coming down to pokes their gills and all sorts of things. So they'll move out into the shallows. And I know guys that have told me about, gosh, you know, we had this big flood and there was all these fish out in my field. And that's because the fish go out there and then the flood goes down so quickly they sort of get trapped out there and can't find their way back.
Mm-hmm.
But they do move out and get out of it.
So that's where you fish.
Yeah, area. I would fish in the quieter water along the edges and those sorts of places.
Okay.
Definitely.
Jim in Jefferson City asks, would you please discuss reading the water after heavy rains? And that's what we just talked about. But that may not mean that the water's muddy. You just mentioned you liked a little, for big browns, you liked a little rain, a little overcast. Any other things that you could help Jim out with in fishing those?
Well, I guess it depends on how much water, you know. I mean, the water they just had in Vermont would not be good fishing.
Yeah, no.
But sometimes sometimes you'll get water that'll come up 6, 10, 12 inches. Well, what happens is, you know, some fish will stay out in the lies that they normally are in if the water's not too fast. But if it comes up and it's got some speed to it, like I say, they'll move out of that heavier water into the shallow ridges. But now the shallow ridges aren't the shallower edges anymore. They've got 6 inches to another foot of water on them. So basically, you have another stream that you got to read all over again.
Exactly.
And while we're at that, we might as well mention that spring season rivers are totally different than fall season rivers, because in the spring season you've got higher water than you do in the fall season. So in the spring you might be reading a riffle, and in the fall you might get there and gosh, there's nothing but just a trickle coming down.
Right.
So
yeah,
fish are going to be in different places, yeah, depending upon and before also when Steph was asking about temperature, you know, there's some that has a very, very profound effect on fish. You know, if the temperatures get too warm, trout are going to go someplace to get their temperatures down. Now, they can feed in warmer waters and might move. For example, you're talking about your lake. I've seen fish come out of water that was cool and go up into the shallows to feed, but they're not staying there all night. You know, they come up, feed a little bit, and go back out into the cool water again. But if you're in a stream situation where the water's warm, you got trouble. So fish will move to deep pools and get down on the bottom. They'll go to places where there might be spring seeps coming in off the bottom. They might move up tributary streams. They'll just go all kinds of places. If the water gets too cold, obviously, and freezes over on top, it's very hard to fly fish. But if it's, you know, if it gets down into the 30s even, fish will feed, but they don't feed as much because they don't need as much food.
Right, right. Well, Duke in New York asks about rising and descending and ascending or rising water. And he said that he noticed, let's see, fish at Spring Creek this year, and he said he noticed that even at the same flow, 100 CFS, it fished better when the water descended than it was ascending or rising. What's your take on that?
I don't know. That's an interesting observation. Like I say, if I know there's brown trout there and I've got a warm rain and the water's coming up just a tiny bit, my goodness, that's when I want to be out there pounding browns, because they just love that. I don't know what the deal was in that particular situation.
Better
when it's descending, unless it's just the fish are moving around a little bit more, trying to move out of the shallows and out into the deeper water. Maybe it's easier to find them out there. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the lies are changing.
Yeah, really. Maybe. Yeah.
I know I was just this weekend floating the upper Colorado and teaching a friend how to row and trying to explain to her how the river changes. And I said, okay, you know, we just went through this class one rapid, but in higher water, that rapid won't even exist. You know, it could be just a long run, and there's no rocks to look for because they're too
deep. All buried, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I said, so every time you come down this river, it's going to be different, you know. And likewise, if you relate that to the lies, every time you go out to the river, it's probably going to be different.
That's going to be different. Yeah. Not only that, but every time you go, there's a different hatch situation or a different food source situation, and fish are going to be in different places to prepare for that and get maximize their food intake. So really, reading the water is sort of an ongoing and continuous kind of process. It really never goes away.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple questions, one that came in on the Internet, and one that came in before the show. One was from Les Booth in Indiana, and the other is from Alan Wheaton, Illinois. And they're both asking about similarities or differences in smallmouth versus trout as to where they hold. Is there a difference, or do they find the same line?
Yeah, smallmouth are basically brown trout bass.
Brown trout bass, okay. So treat
there's
them
a lot
way,
of times
huh?
when you'll find brown trout, especially right at the lower end of what we might call the lower end of trout water, where it starts to warm up a little bit. You can find big browns mixed in with bass, and they basically occupy the same kinds of waters and feed on the same kinds of things. And big browns like to feed on crayfish just like smallmouth do. And I mean, I fished a lot for smallmouth when I was a kid, and we just basically would fish exactly the same kind of water we'd fish for trout, especially in the evening when the smallmouth would move up out of the deeper pools and get up into the riffles and start feeding on crayfish and stuff. So really, smallmouth bass are not much different than reading the water for them. Is not really any different than reading it for trout. Smallmouth like rocky areas because there's a lot of crayfish around there. So, you know, but during the daytime, they're not going to be up in the shallow water. They're going to be down in the deep pools, just like trout are going to be, hiding from any predators and so on, unless there's something to get them out. And smallmouth will feed on mayflies just like trout will.
Right, right. Okay. Jim in Jefferson City, and he has several questions here in a row, but First one is there any differences between how stock trout versus wild trout feed?
Yeah, there's a huge difference between stalkers and wild trout. Number one, stock trout have been raised to like people. When people come by, that means food's coming. So you walk by the trout in the pond, and they all zip over to your side and splash like crazy. Where's our food? Where's our food? You walk by a wild trout, they're gone. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge difference there. Second difference is stock trout are not used to feeding on the things that are out in the river like wild trout are. So they basically have to learn to do that. Now, all trout feed by what we call sampling the drift. In other words, they don't go, oh, today is June 23rd. That means there's going to be a pale morning dun hatch on the Madison, so I think I'll swim over there and have some pale morning duns. You know, they're just there, and whatever comes by, they taste it, and if it's good, they eat it, and if not, they spit it out. And if they eat on something and it tastes good, and they see another one coming by that looks sort of like it, they'll try that one, and if that one's good, they'll try the next one, and then they can get locked in on that, and that's what selective feeding is. They get locked in on one organism to the exclusion of all others, and they do that by sampling the drift. So that's just the way they all feed like that. And if you've got the kind of day when you've got a big hatch going on, they get focused on that. Otherwise, they're just watching whatever's coming by. But the stock trout have to learn how to do that. Because here all their life, their food's always come from above, and it's always round and about, a quarter of an inch long. Sort of olivey-colored or brownish-colored pellets. Mm-hmm. And you put them in a river, what do they know about anything of an insect or anything else? So they'll be sampling the drift, fussing around, and probably 90% of those fish will die within the first 2 months.
Really?
Or less,
Because they starve to death more than...
Yeah, they just
starve
to death.
Or get caught and put on the string.
And the other thing is that stock trout are used to all living together. Wild trout don't want to live together. Mm-hmm. They get together when they're scared, otherwise they move out and have their positions, their feeding lies where they're holding, or prime lies where they're holding. And if other fish come in there, they'll chase them away. Well, what's a wild trout to do when here comes 400 guys all hanging out with him? He's chasing them all, trying to get. And they've actually discovered when you plant stock trout into a wild trout population, it decreases the number of wild trout that survive.
Wow.
Not because people are catching them, but just because the wild trout are stressed so heavily by all these fish that have no concept of what being wild is all about.
Yeah, interesting.
So if they're going to stalk rivers, they got to publish where the stalking's going to be and what time they're going to actually put them in and let them come and just catch their limit and take them home.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what the process is.
Yeah, and we did a show recently with Anders Howerson about, the whole, he wrote a whole book on rainbows and how they were stalked across the U.S. and the world. Very interesting. Very interesting read, and basically it was, a lot of them are there just for the put and take aspect.
Yeah, the synthetic fish.
Fish, exactly. So Jim also asked about differences between rainbows and browns and where they, do they?
Yeah, there are great differences among the trouts. The brown trout is a different genus. It's in Salmo. And the rainbow trout is Oncorhynchus, the same as the Pacific salmon, as are the cutthroat and all the other ones of the Western Mountains. They're all Oncorhynchus. So, number one, they're different. They're different genera. Number two, brown trout, of all of the trouts that, all lump together, trouts, chars, and Oncorhynchus, lump them all together as trouts. Brown trout are the wariest, spookiest of all of them. You go into a hatchery where there's young fish. I mean, by young, I mean, like an inch long. And they're just got them in big tanks. You walk by where the brook trout are, they all come down to your end and splash on top hoping to get fed. You walk by where the tank where the rainbows are, they all come running down and splash on the surface hoping to get fed. You walk by the brown trout tank, they run to the other end and go to the bottom. That's just the way they are. Genetically, they're that way. So the browns, people say, well, the browns are the best predators, and so they live the longest, and you can't catch all the brown trout. Well, if you put browns and rainbows and brook trout in a river and fish for them, the browns will end up being the last ones there because they're the hardest ones to catch.
No.
Not because they're the predators. They're just the hardest ones to catch. No. Brookies are probably the easiest, although they can be very wild at times. But stalked rainbows are, you know, they're pretty easy because they're so used to humans. Any of
right.
the stalked fishes are.
Yeah, yeah. So that goes back with the Browns, back to life rule number one, right?
Oh, yeah. They really got that one down.
Yeah.
And you go out and fish something like Armstrong Spring Creek in Montana, and you go out there and there's pale morning dunhatch is going on. You wade up the middle of it, and there's fish rising all over the place, and you'll catch them. They'll all be rainbows. But if you really look carefully along the, right along the edge of the bank, underneath the crest beds and where there's a clump of sod hanging down, you'll see these little tiny rises, and you throw it in there. It turns out it's a great big old brown trout because they're hiding. They just, classically, they want to be under something, away from people, away from everything. Just they're just very, very spooky.
Okay. Getting into more specific waters here. We had a question from Steve Perry in Monument, Colorado, and he says, would like to know if you have a general approach towards seams regarding depth. Do you start deep and work your way up, vice versa, or another approach?
Yeah, again, it's some of these things we've talked about. It depends on what things are going on relative to the food sources. And if there's a heavy food source, I'd start shallow because that's where the fish are going to be out in the shallow feeding lies. If there's nothing to get them up on top, obviously, then the fish are going to be deeper. Now, when I say that, I want to qualify that by saying sometimes there are things to get them up on top that you don't see. For example, there might be beetles falling in from the surrounding pine trees and stuff, and the fish are watching for them, but you don't see a beetle hatch. So
right.
you don't actually see beetles flying off the water and flying away. They're just floating along in the river. And you may not see those at all unless you really, really pay attention. So there might be fish feeding, fish out in the shallows watching for beetles, and you never see the beetles, and you just walk over fish and don't even pay attention to them.
Right.
But generally, I would think about where the food source is going to be. Think about this. Grasshoppers, for example. I mean, when there's grasshoppers falling in, you don't see big lines of grasshoppers coming down. No. Probably don't see them because the fish get everyone that comes in. But
yeah.
there'll be fish out in the shallows. I mean, you know, we talked about the bighorn. And
yeah.
one of the things I like about the bighorn are their big riffles. And you get a grasshopper, you know, late in the summer when the grasshoppers are in, there'll be fish all over that riffle watching for grasshoppers. So you go up there, and it could be right in shallow water along the bank, or they could be out in the center, or there could be a gravel bar in the middle. There'll be fish backed up behind that watching for hoppers.
Yeah.
Just like I said, depends on what's happening. And each time you go, it's like a different river.
Right. Well, let's talk about riffles. That's next on my questions here. And what makes up the riffles? How do the fish hold in there, and where do we look for them? How do we fish a riffle?
Well, a riffle is an area where the bottom's inclined enough such that the current can scrape away mud and sand and maybe even some finer particles of gravel, leaving basically bigger rocks, maybe a boulder or two here or there. And it goes fast enough that when it strikes the face of the rocks, it stands up and makes a wave over top of the rock. So a riffle is characterized by standing waves, not very much white water. Maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, but breaks over a big rock or something. But generally we think of riffles as dancing along, jingling. Those are terms that have been used. The water is dancing more than it is just roaring or plowing down through there like it would be in a rapids. In those kind of places, fish will hold behind the rocks. Every rock produces what we call a hydraulic slip. As the water goes over the top of it, there's a quiet spot behind the rock. And it's just like a boat slip. It's a place where the fish can park and be out of the current. You can see fish holding in a riffle, and they're hardly moving at all. They're not wagging their tail. Maybe they'll move their fins a little bit. That's because they're in one of these slips where there's really not any current at all. And fish will stay there and simply watch for food items coming by in the current. And that's one of the reasons that when a fish takes a fly in a riffle, it usually takes it quickly because the water is moving quickly, and it doesn't have it in its window for very long. It can't see it for very long, so it's going to move quickly to take it, whereas under other situations, it may spend a lot of time watching the fly or move a longer ways to take it. But in riffles, they have to move fairly quickly to take the fly.
And they will move into the current to get that.
And they will move into the current to get it. Then they go back to their slip again.
Yeah, I've had it real interesting up here in the South Platte River. I was on a bridge and just watching the fish from above on the bridge and doing just that. You know, they're in their little eye, and then something comes on. You see their head poke out, grab it,
yeah.
Right back, poke out, grab it, right back.
Yeah.
And they use very little energy.
But they
must see that coming from, you know, I mean, the timing has to be perfect, obviously.
Yeah,
but,
oh, yeah. They can move quickly. Oh, they can go zip over there and get it and come right back so quick.
So when you're working a riffle, I notice when I've fished riffles, a lot of times it's hard to see in the water and actually spot fish.
Especially in riffles it is, yeah.
Yeah. So do you just kind of work that as kind of a grid in thinking that there might be
fish depends on
almost
every... Again, it depends on the actual character of the riffle. For example, let's say it's a shallow riffle, but it's got a real deep slot along one side. In that case, I might spend a few seconds casting around in the shallower water just to make sure that there's nothing in there. And if there's no hatch going on or there's nothing that indicates that there might be fish in the shallows, I want that slot. Because that darker water is going to be more favorable for fish. They're going to feel more comfortable in there. And I've fished those kind of places and just caught tons of fish out of them over the years.
Okay. And without a slot, then?
If it's just a riffle of absolute uniform depth side to side, yeah, then I cover it like a grid. I fish a little block, maybe 10 by 10 square feet, maybe only 10 to 15 feet upstream from me, very close.
Mm-hmm.
So the furthest cast I'm making is maybe 25 feet. And then I'll move over and fish the next little block, move over. You have to do it systematically because they can be spread out any place. And if you don't know where they are, that's
right.
The best way.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to actually fish for them.
Yeah. You have to do some work.
That's right.
So you just mentioned one thing that you do to get the most out of riffles, which is looking for a slot or a little deeper
area.
Yeah,
deeper pockets and that kind of thing, yeah.
Anything else that we would look for in riffles?
You know, at the top end, right where the riffles dump out of the pool, at the tail out of the pool a lot of times, there's a sort of a sharp edge, and you can see almost like a seam coming down. There may be a little quieter water to the side, and then the riffle coming down, and there's a seam along the edge of that riffle. Man, that is a spot. You need to always fish that, even if it's only 6 inches deep.
Okay.
That's a spot because it's a place where you get a little bit of turbulence, and turbulence means slow water, and they'll hold in that, and they can watch anything that's coming down. And big fish will go into those kind of places.
Okay. You mentioned pools, so let's talk about pools.
Okay.
In your book, you talk about different zones of a pool. Can you explain that?
Yeah, if we sort of think about it from the top end, you know, you've got the head of the pool, the throat is where the fast water comes in. And on either side of that, usually you have reverse currents. Now, of course, it depends on the shape of the pool. There are so many different pool shapes, but let's just take a classic pool that's straight through. So you've got the riffle or rapids coming in at the top. You've got a reverse current on either side of that. Then you have the edges of the pool, which can vary widely from shallow little flat areas to overhung with trees and, you know, grass and all kinds of stuff. Then you have the belly of the pool or the gut of the pool, the big, deep, heavy part, and then the tail out of the pool. All of those offer different kinds of lies and different potentials for you as a fly fisher. The head is, like we talked about before, that's a really good prime lie. If the water in that riffle is more than knee-deep, right up there where it comes out of the riffle and dumps down into the deep water of the pool, that is the spot. That's the place
we're talking about on the bighorns.
Yeah, that's the prime lie. You'll always find fish in there. Over on the green, you know, 20,000 mile fish a mile on the green, well, there's about 5,000 of them stacked at the top of each one of those pools. And it's black in there with fish sometimes. There's so many of them. But any place, any river that you fish, that's always a good spot to find a big fish. And then probably the least thought about are the edges. Most people think about, okay, the tail out of the pool, that's good in the evening, and that's good. It's shallow water during a hatch. Great feeding lies back there. The deep part of the pool, well, maybe I can dredge some out of there on a sinking line and a sculpin or something like that, imitation, you know. But the edges generally tend to just get weighted. And again, we need to think about this from the standpoint of the fish. Gosh, where's a really good food source? If there's brush and trees and all kinds of other stuff, there's all kinds of things falling out of that all the time. And that's always a good place to be watching, even if it's relatively shallow. Big fish will move in there if there's food to take them in there. They'll go in there. So we need to just move more carefully, think about it a little bit. Gee, if I was a big fish, why would I be laying in this shallow water? Well, the only thing that's going to get me in there is going to be food. Is there a food source that would get me in there? Well, no, there isn't. So you start to walk, and all of a sudden you flush out a big one because you've been in there eating crayfish. You didn't think about crayfish.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just going to say. Some of those are pretty still waters over on
yeah.
the edges. And I was just going to say, well, are there going to be any fish? But, well, you just explained why. So,
yeah, well, I mean, when you walk along the edge of a pool, you see all these minnows along the edge. Well, that's a lot of food.
Mm-hmm.
And big fish will go in those shallows and feed on those minnows. So, I think Joe Brooks' advice to don't wait it until you fish it's probably the best advice that you could give anybody in terms of reading water. Don't fish it. Don't wait it till you fish it.
Bob Keaton asks, he says, I've always been told to look for the bubble line, but I always mm-hmm. wondered what's the more productive part of it, and should you concentrate further out from it? So, and I think the bubble line, the seam he's talking about.
Yeah. Well, anytime you get foam lines in a river, you've got some kind of a current tongue that's leading that foam. And if it's leading foam, it's obviously leading food. So if there's a hatch on, you'll see bugs going down the foam line, and you'll see fish feeding in foam lines. And even if there's not readily, like I say, available, noticeable insects on the water, like there might be beetles. We were fishing up one time in Yellowstone Park, Nancy and Jason and I, and we looked down over the cliff, and there's this big foam line. I was watching it with the binoculars, and I could see fish packed up in the foam line. So we went down and looked. There's nothing on the water at all, but there's all those pine trees there, so we put on a black beetle and threw it out and immediately started to catch some fish. They were there watching for these beetles that were coming down, because the beetles would stack up wherever the foam stacks up. Anything that's floating on the surface is going to stack up in the same spot. So, yeah, foam is always a good indicator. If the foam piles up, food piles up, fish pile up.
Now, when we've got, let's say we've got a big boulder, and mm-hmm. we've got two seams down the side and foam's there, are the fish are then in the out of the current, maybe under the foam, and looking towards the current?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're not really looking for food in that pocket water behind it. Is that correct? Or
usually not. Although, you know, if they're at the sides and something comes into that pocket close to them, they'll probably move over there and take it because they're watching every direction all at the same time. Their eyes work independently, so one of them can be watching that direction, one can be watching the other direction. And their eyes are also modified to be able to see movement and contrast. So if something moves, they'll immediately turn toward it to see what it is. Now, let's just mention this while we're talking about big boulders. Another place that a lot of people don't think about is in front of the boulder. That's what we call a hydraulic cushion. The water strikes the face of the boulder and rebounds a little bit. In fact, if you look at boulders in a rapids, the water at the upstream edge will always be higher than it is in the downstream edge, because of that rebound.
Mm-hmm.
So big fish will park out in front because it's a great place to get food. It's coming down. It slows down as the water strikes that boulder. And they'll park out there in that place. Boy, that's a good spot. And then they park along the edges, of course, because the boulder provides some cover and protection and that sort of thing. And if it's a slightly rounded boulder, that can be a great prime line, because they'll just sort of hold onto the edge of that thing and watch that seam and watch for food coming down.
So to fish a boulder like that, the best thing to do is to work it from upstream and just let it pass around it naturally, I guess.
You can do that, or you can fish it from downstream, too.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm fishing, let's say I'm casting a leech or something like that, I would work that from upstream and work it into that hydraulic cushion. And I try to swing it so that I can be as close, as straight upstream as possible, and swing it in and just let it hang in there.
Mm, okay.
And, I mean, sometimes you can't, obviously, because of the fast water and positioning, but I try to get as much of a downstream angle on it as I possibly can. And then fishing around the edges of it, you can nymph around the edge, you can fish, float a dry fly, around the edges of that thing. You can fish a leech, for example, like a nymph, with a piece of shot above it, and just pitch it up and bounce it back down along the edges. You can even use indicators on them. I've done that lots of times.
Okay. We need to take a quick break again.
All right.
When we come back, we'll explore this some more. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about reading waters. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately and try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Gary, we do have a few that came in on the Internet here, so let me see.
All right.
Ralph in Parker, Colorado, wants to know, do you ever catch trout in back eddies?
Absolutely.
That's the still water we were just talking about.
Yep, that's the still water. In fact, that can be a really great place to find fish cruising around as long as the water temperature is, you know, low enough that the trout can survive in there, and as long as there's some kind of food source in those kind of places, darn right they'll go back in there. In fact, that's another one of those kind of places a lot of people walk by and think, they call it frog water. Well,
right.
It's not really, it might be, and they might be back there eating the frogs, too.
Well, we've got another one here, Dennis in Neshanic Station. He says, please describe how you would approach nymph fishing in water less than 12 inches deep.
Well, there's a couple of ways you can do that. Probably the best way, and that depends on whether you're nymph fishing, you know, the film, or whether you're trying to nymph fish on the bottom. If you're nymph fishing the film, obviously you can just use a grease leader or put a hanging indicator on there a few inches up from the fly. But if I'm fishing on the bottom in that relatively shallow water, probably the best way is the hopper-dropper concept. You don't have to use a hopper. You can use any dry fly, or you can use an indicator and just hang it, you know, 6-8 inches. I mean, hang the fly about 10 or 12 inches below it and just drift it through there. That's a really good way to do it, because you really, in that shallow water, you need something that's going to suspend the fly above the bottom, but not too far above the bottom, and not allow your line and leader to get down so that it hangs the fly up on the bottom. So using some kind of an indicator, and then just hang your fly underneath it and fish it that way. That's a really good way to do it.
Got a question from Bob Nunn in Ocean City, New Jersey. And Bob's a longtime listener, but he asks, considering what's happened there recently, he says, how should fishing be conducted as the eastern floodwaters recede?
Well, I think I'd wait until they got low enough so my life wasn't threatened by them. I mean, there's some serious water back there.
Yeah.
And the other thing, you know, again, if the waters go down relatively slowly, the fish will be able to find their way back into the rivers and all that kind of stuff, and they probably won't be hung up in the woods and so on. If they go down very quickly, sometimes you can get fish hung up in the woods or little ponded areas off the stream and that sort of thing. But again, I would, when I'm fishing it, I would start by fishing the edges again, especially if the water's a little bit high. And then as the water goes back down, again, you're going to have to reread everything because those pools and riffles are going to just change completely with those. Those floods were catastrophic. Those were 100-year floods or more than 100-year floods. Some of them were.
And the structures probably all changed.
They've just changed everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the trout are going to get killed by that. I mean, they're going to get flushed there's just so much water.
Yeah.
And they'll try to get out of it. They'll try to move out to the sides, but... You know, they're just so much water coming down.
Yeah.
So I think I would start by just fishing the shallow edges.
Okay.
And by shallow, I mean down to maybe waist deep, you know.
Right.
Those kind of edges. Mm-hmm.
We've got Tori in Torrington, Connecticut. He says, you talked a bit about stocked versus wild trout and their feeding habits and spookiness. How about where each tends to lie in the stream? You find differences there?
Yeah, you know, stock trout generally have been raised in tanks, and so they generally tend to occupy pools more than they will riffles, and they generally tend to hold in groups. I can remember when I was a kid growing up in Pennsylvania, one of the places when they would stock, of course, at the bridges, and one of the places that always held fish was right by the bridge, there was a center pier, and it had gouged out sort of a long, deep pool right there. And it was just like a big old trough, you know, in the hatchery, and they just line up in that thing. And, of course, anglers would line up there, too, but they would always go to those kind of places where the water was a little bit slower and where it was more like a trough rather than being up in the riffles or way down in the deep part of the pools or that kind of places. So I think they do occupy different spots, but, of course, they put a lot of pressure on any of the wild trout that happen to be there, too. Mm-hmm. And eventually, given enough time, they will disperse if they don't die first.
We got a question from Tori in Torrington. What are your thoughts on how heavy angling pressure affects trouts in streams and rivers?
Well, it depends on whether it's catch and release or whether it's catch and kill. If it's catch and kill, basically you will convert it to a brown trout feeding after dark river, if there's brown trout in there. Because what happens is you kill all the fish that feed during the daytime. It's not that brown trout go, oh, if I eat in the daytime, I'm going to get caught. No, they're not that smart. It's that brown trout like cover, and night is cover. And so what happens is the big browns come out and feed at night, not because they're smart, but because they're just spooky. And all the other fish during the daytime, they get caught and killed. Now, if it's a river where it's catch and release, you'll find fish feeding basically all the time, day and night. And maybe the bigger browns will be feeding at night just because they like the dark better than they like the daytime. But again, you get an overcast day, get a hatch going on an overcast day, you can find all the big browns right out there feeding then too.
Okay, we've got a question from Chris in Potterville, and this is from the Internet as well. Is it better to fish upstream or downstream in a riffle?
Ooh, both directions. Depends on what you're fishing. If I'm fishing with something like a streamer fly or a leech fly or a bucktail or something, I like to fish those in riffles. I like to fish those downstream. And what I do is I cast. If you can think about this, for example, this is a technique I call the bait fish from L, because you've got to make the line into an L shape. So you're going to cast slightly across the current, and you're going to curve the end of the line around so that the fly lands closer to shore, just for an example. Now, because the fly has landed near shore, the line from the fly out is basically straight, and then it makes a curve and comes up to you. And the line is going slightly across the current, so the current pushes against the line, and that draws the fly straight out from the bank. So rather than just casting across and letting it swing, I hook it around on the end so that it tends to come straight out. That gives a fish a look at the profile of the fly. Rather than seeing the back end of it going across, it sees the side of the fly going across. Mm-hmm. That can be that's just a lethal way to fish them that way.
Great.
So, yeah, when I'm fishing riffles, I like to go down and I do it that way. And if it's shallow enough, I can sort of wade and cast in along the sides, fine and dandy. If it's not, then I'll just try to fish through the water where I suspect there might be the most amount of fish and get the fly going straight across that kind of water by positioning the line correctly.
Got a question again from the Internet, and it's got a little story with it. But I know you'll appreciate this because you probably were there at one time with Jason like this. He says, my son Jake, 5 years old, and I are just starting to fish together with the fly rod. We wondered what you'd recommend for us to find and catch fish together. He can make an awesome mess of his fly line and stomps around like an elephant, but occasionally lays out a nice 15-foot cast. When and where will the fish be most likely to take his fly?
Well, I tell everybody when you take kids fishing, take them someplace they can catch fish or someplace where they can throw a lot of stones. Now, if you got a bluegill pond, that's the place to go because bluegills will take the fly even if he slops it out there and stomps around like an elephant.
Yeah.
You know, and the nice thing about bluegills is they're cooperative. It's a fish. He's caught it. He's enjoyed it by himself, you know, and that will help him to appreciate the sport and give him a lifelong sport that it's something that he can do in the outdoors and really enjoy himself. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, hey, just don't worry about it. You know, take him out there, and if he doesn't want to fish that day, fine and dandy. If he likes to be with Dad, that's the important part. He'll get it.
Yeah. I know. I think that's when I started, was with actually bluegills and largemouth bass.
Sure.
Little, you know, like 10-inch largemouth.
Yeah, but when you're little, they fight pretty good.
Yeah. And they take a dry fly, a mosquito off the surface, and it's quite exciting. So.
They sure do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a couple more things here. Let's see. We got some questions. Dick Reddick, Rednick in Worcestershire, Massachusetts, says, can you share any ways of estimating the depth of water in a pool in order to be drifting a nymph near the bottom? And maybe he's taking the wrong approach there based upon our previous conversation.
Well, yeah, there are ways of estimating water depth and thinking about it. If you look straight down into water, it will appear to be about one-third as deep as it really... Well, I should say, let's see. Not one-third. It will appear to be about two-thirds of its real depth. So if the water is really 6 feet deep, it'll look like it's 4 feet deep. You'll have that kind of perception. If you're standing and looking into the pool, it always appears shallower than it really is. If you go in a swimming pool and go to the shallow end and put your face down so that your eyes are just above the surface, the 12-foot deep end will look like it's about 2 inches deep, just because the light is bending as it comes out of the water, and it will bring the bottom up. So it's always shallower than you think it is. If you're 30 feet away, it's probably three times deeper than it looks. If you're 20 feet away, it's probably twice as deep as it looks. And if you're 10 feet away, it's probably 1.5 times as deep as it looks.
I think that's the best rule. Yeah, rule kind of applies when you're waiting,
yeah.
Right?
Start waiting out, and
you think, God, that doesn't look very deep. And then you step there at the top of your waders.
That's right.
Yeah.
I know lots of guys that step in and, gosh almighty, I thought I was only up to my knees. I'm pretty near drowned, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Or all of a sudden you're floating downstream.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
all you have to do is stand and look directly into the water and look at your feet. Your legs, you go, what happened to my legs? You know, they're so short.
Yeah.
Or look at your buddy's legs when he's standing in the water.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you just think 30 feet, it's three times as deep. 20 feet, it's twice as deep. 10 feet, it's 1.5 times as deep.
Great.
That's a good way of thinking about it.
Well, let's talk about rapids for a few minutes here. What makes a rapid different than a riffle? And what are the productive parts of a rapid that you would want to fish?
Well, if you fall in, you'd rather drift through a riffle than a rapid. That's for sure. A rapid is a place where the bottom's inclined so steeply that it takes out not only the sand and gravel and mud, but it also takes out a lot of the stones. And now you have a lot of boulders and very fast water, a lot of white water, because it goes so fast that it boils over top of the stones and boils around the stones. And rapids are categorized basically by the fact that there's a lot of white water there. And I suppose you could look at actual physical current speeds, but we don't have any real way of measuring that as anglers, other than the fact that it looks really fast, and it is really fast. Riffles, you think about, that's a nice sunny day, jingly, nice fun kind of water. Rapids, that's like... Yeah, lightning and thunder, and it's a heavy place, and I'm not sure I want to be in there. And just think about the Madison River. You know, that's rapids. Definitely fast, heavy, deep water. Not the kind of stuff you want to be wading around in and playing around in. Now, since we're talking about rapids, this is where in the book Reading Waters, I mentioned the Secret River, which in rapids is basically the shore water, the near shore water where it's slow. And that's the water where everybody wades and nobody fishes, and it should be exactly the other way around. They should fish that before they ever get into it. That is the best water in the whole rapids, by far. But everybody thinks, oh, no, the big ones live out in the middle behind those big rocks. Well, is there any food out there? You got tremendously fast current they got to swim through? Nah, they hang out in that shallow water near shore. So especially in rapids, really, really pay attention to that near shore water. You go fish with my old buddy Mike Lawson up there and fish the Madison. First thing he tells these guys, okay, cast in. They go, what? That's only 5 feet out from shore. I thought they all lived out in the middle. You know, they cast in, they catch a huge fish, and then they realize, yeah, the kind of water that you typically would wade through because it's easy to wade in, well, gee, it's easy to swim in. Mm-hmm. There's all this food coming from the bank, hoppers and, you know, and beetles and ants, and then you watch the insects coming down. There's tons of them next to the quiet water. They spin out of the fast water into the quiet water along the shore. So it makes every bit of sense to fish that water and really pay attention to it. Now, I'm not saying that fish don't live out in the middle and aren't around rapids and there aren't gravel bars out there where there can be fish stacked up and all that kind of stuff. But pay a lot more attention to that near-shore water, that secret river. Now, here's the other thing. You go float fishing, and you float down to Madison. And you're floating with, let's say, Bob Jacklin. You're floating down the Madison. What does he tell you? Cast against the shore. I told you to get your fly back next to the shore, and you're throwing it 2 inches away. Throw it on the shore if you can't get it that close then. You know? And you're going like, what? I thought they all lived out in the middle. And you know, the guys that are floating want to fish the bank, and the guys that are wading want to fish the middle. So, you know, someplace in between those two, there's got to be fish available.
Yeah,
and it's really that near-shore water that holds a lot of fish, but guys just wade over top of it or cast over it and spook the fish.
Yeah, I know on the upper Colorado, you know, working those streamers along the edge.
Oh, yeah.
The standard way that you work that river. And the same thing on the Madison. You know, that's the Kelly Gallup up there with his big
absolutely
long flies, you know, working the sides there. Yeah.
Yep.
We got a question from Joe in Lorain, Ohio, and he's asking about your advice on reading and fishing pocket water. Do you use dries and droppers, nymphi stick, indicator? What's your approach?
Yeah, again, that depends on the size of the river, what's available in terms of food. And, you know, if it's a small stream and basically the pockets are the only place where the fish are, then you can fish dry flies and have a really great time. If the water's a little deeper and it's a little bit bigger stream and you don't see any surface activity and you try a dry fly a little bit and you don't get anything, then I'd be fishing, you know, a little bit deeper. Now, there's different techniques for getting the fly into the pocket depending upon how deep the pocket is and so on. For example, you can curve cast across stream so that the fly lands downstream of the line. In other words, you hook the fly around so the fly is downstream of the line leader. That way it can sink more quickly and get into the bottom of those pockets. So I know some places where the water goes out of maybe a foot and a half deep and drops into like 4 or 5 feet of water, and there'll be a fish right down in the bottom there. Well, the only way you can get a fly in there is to hook it like that. When you curve it, you know, that if it's a weighted fly, beadhead or something, it'll dive right down to the bottom in that kind of water. If it's, you know, just small pockets, like I said, you can fish a dry, you can fish them upstream with a dry and a bead head or something like that, and do just very fine. This depends. It sort of depends on the river style and so on, and how deep the water is and how fast it is, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, because when we're talking about small streams, those fish are keyed in on a lot of terrestrials.
Right.
So the dry fly fishing should be great.
But, yep.
On a larger stream, then we're looking more maybe at the nymphing side of things.
Yep. Or more big leeches or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Terry in Fort Collins, Colorado, asks about runs. Talking about runs, when fishing a medium-sized river, 20 to 30 feet wide, and there is a large flatwater stretch, 100 feet long, is it worth fishing the middle of this run, or more productive at the beginning and the ends?
That depends. Now, whether it's a run or a flat, I mean, it could be a wide area where the water is relatively slow and shallow, that's a flat. If it's a run, it's going to be water that's a little bit faster usually, more like you'd find in a riffle or even almost approaching a rapids in terms of speed. But it doesn't have a bunch of big boulders and stuff in it, and it's usually fairly deep in the center.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of places can have really, really big fish in them. The Bighorn's got some nice runs like that, and so does the Madison and other places. And Charlie Brooks, who lived up in West Yellowstone for a lot of years, loved to fish those big runs on the Madison because that's where he got his biggest browns always. A lot of guys, again, think that the big fish are always going to be in the center. That's just not the case. You know, I would again fish those edges. And, you know, I fish the center too sometimes, and I'll use maybe a couple of split shot to get the fly down on the bottom. Sometimes it's pretty hard to get them down in that deep water. But there'll be fish all through a run, not just at the top end or at the lower end. In a flat, the water generally goes a little bit slower and generally tends to be more uniform in depth from bank to bank. And again, those are kind of places, if the water's a little deeper, there can be fish any place in those things. And they're kind of places where you really need to spend some time studying, looking, watching, see if you see anything moving, see if you see any rises. Now, sometimes you can sit there and watch, and all of a sudden you see a fish rise. Maybe he's come up to take a beetle off the top or something. And you wouldn't have seen him if you just glanced out there and said, oh, it's a flat, and I'm not going to fish that and walk on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would spend some time watching.
Yeah, yeah.
When you think about Henry's Fork, that's practically all a flat, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Hard to know. And observation, that's the other thing. Two things we probably don't pay enough attention to is fishing those shallows and doing more observing than
that's
fishing.
Right.
Yeah. We'd probably all be better fly fishers, I think. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up. Stay with me here, Gary, because we're going to give away your book here in a minute.
Sure. Okay.
So that latest of Gary's books, Reading Waters, we're going to be giving away. We're also going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So stick with us here a few more minutes, and we'll do just that. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon in the planet, some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org. And that's a place you can learn more about how you can get involved with saving this incredible fishery. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd surely appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database, so if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show, and you don't want to miss out on some of these great gifts that we have to give away. So our first drawing will be for the one-year membership of the Federation of Fly Fishers, and this is a great organization to support. I know Gary's been a part of that his whole life, I believe. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can read about all the things they do in the way of education and support of fly fishing. So our person that's going to win that is George, and his last name is Bida, B-I-E-D-A, I probably mispronounced that, but George Bida in Washington, you just won a one-year membership to the Federation. If you already have a membership will get it extended for you. So congratulations. We'll contact you by email to give you the information on how you can get that your winnings there. And now we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and that is going to Frank Adams in Tennessee. So enjoy, Frank. That is a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. And for those of you that didn't win the subscription, you can go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, and take a look at that magazine. Great, great periodical. Okay, so now we'll give away Gary's book here, and I ask a question about something we talked about in the show. And I just need to clear my queue here. Sure. So you need to go to our homepage, type in the answer there along with your name and your location, and the first person to answer correctly will win Gary's new book. And the question is, when we were talking about rapids, Gary used a term for the real fishable area in a rapid that's he has a special name for, and he has it in his book. What is the name of that area of or in around the rapid that Gary used in a special word for that? So let me see here, Gary, if we got First answer is Prime. That's not what I was looking for, was it, Gary?
Nope.
Nope. Special name. Home line. Nope. I think this one might be it. This one is Secret River. Is that what I was looking for, Gary?
That's it.
That's it, Secret River. Well, Matt Schoen, I can't get your name. Matt, you know who you are in Baltimore there. You just won Gary's new book, Reading Waters. And, Gary, you know, we didn't talk about this. Well, first, Matt, send in your name, your address, and contact information. I've already got your email address here. You can use the same text box you just used to send that information in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com so I can pass that on to Gary and he can send you that book. And Gary, where can people get your books that aren't fortunate enough to win one?
They can go online to my blog, GaryBorger.com, mm-hmm. and there all the ordering information is right there.
Great, great. So GaryBorger.com, GaryBorger.com. And you can find out about all of Gary's books there. So appreciate that. Well, Gary, thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
My pleasure, Roger.
I don't know how many shows we've done, 3 or 4 now with you, and sounds like we got about 26 more to go or so. Considering the books that you're going to be publishing. So it'll be lots of fun and
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Our next broadcast will be on September 21st at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll interview Ralph Cutter, and the topic for our show will be fish food. Ralph Cutter literally wrote the book on fish food. To write fish food, he donned his snorkeling gear and studied species underwater. Listen in to learn what Ralph has discovered about food trout eat and why. It's sure to make you a better fly fisher. So we'd like to thank today the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Power Fibers Online Magazine, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Front Range Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.